Up, up, my friend, and clear your looks. Why all this toil and trouble? Up, up, my friend, and quit your books, or surely you'll grow double. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Troubadour Podcast on Sunday Morning Poetry. Today we'll be reading The Tables Turned, an evening scene on the same subject by William Wordsworth. Again, this is from the 1798 Lyrical Ballads. The 1802 and the later versions that Wordsworth tinkered with throughout his life and that you'll find online are going to be slightly different. For instance, the Why All This Toil and Trouble and Or Surely You'll Grow Double are flipped. They're the same lines, but first, you know, in a later version, it says first you're going to grow double and why are you having all this trouble? So the doubling goes first and then the trouble later. So, which, you know, I think maybe makes sense in its own right too. But anyway, this is the 1798 version. I'm trying to stick to that as much as possible. Today, I'm going to do something a little bit different. I'm going to be doing some quotes from outside of the poem itself. I'm going to be reading from Wordsworth's preface to the 1798, what he called his advertisement to the 1798 version of this poem or the book Lyrical Ballads. And then I'm going to also read his preface or a sentence or two from his preface of the 1802 version. And then I'm going to read an outside source. This is a book I just started reading from C. Bradley Thompson called America's Revolutionary Mind, A Moral History of the American Revolution and the Declaration that Defined It. And this is coinciding, just so everyone is aware, you know, I think this is maybe clear for those of you following, my interest in studying not only Wordsworth and Coleridge, but the entire Romantic Revolution. So this is an era that we're reading in that was revolutionary in a lot of ways. I mean, revolution was in the air all across the planet, and the planet that mattered, the Western world. And so the ideas that are shaping America that is in Bradley Thompson's book are in a different way shaping the minds of people in Europe and in Britain. Locke, who is commented on and extensively talked about, John Locke, that is the English philosopher, is an English philosopher. And he is impacting Wordsworth intensely. And same with Newton. When Wordsworth was at Cambridge, where he was a pretty good student, he wasn't the best, he wasn't as good as he had hoped, but they had high hopes for him. He did quite well. He was already considered a good poet, and people had high hopes for his poetic and literary career. He would often walk around the statue of Newton and revere and look up to him. He studied Newton intensely. He was very in awe of what he did. So when we think of the Romantics as a backlash against reason and reality and, you know, things of that nature and all of classicism, this is too oversimplified. And I do not like that people keep propagating that false view. The Romantics were intensely passionate and aware of the classicist ideas and agreed with much of the core tenets of the Enlightenment, but they had their own additional flair, passion, was an imagination in particular. Imagination is probably, if you want to remember one word for the Romantic Revolution, imagination, imagination, imagination. If you want to remember three words, those three words are important. That is the core tenet, the thing that you will bow down before, that you will pray before, the temple of imagination. Now, what the imagination is, that's a whole conversation, and I'm going to touch on that slightly, but we've been talking about it a lot recently. So I'm going to put this on the, if you're watching on TroubadourMag.com, or if you're on the Facebook or YouTube channels of Troubadour Mag, then I will put up a quote from the 1798 version of the Lyrical Ballads that we will, that I'll read, and then I'm going to kind of give you a couple other passages, and then we're going to finish with a couple passages from America's Revolutionary Mind. Now, why I'm doing this and what's going on is we're getting close to the end of lyrical ballads. If you've been following, or if you want to go back, you can follow. But I've been doing all of the 1798 lyrical ballads. I just did a special edition on holiday, or on Halloween, for The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And then I'm going to wrap it all up at the end with Tintern Abbey. And then I'll be putting together possibly an ebook if anyone's interested, but a long blog post with all the links and everything and all the poems in one location. So you can have lyrical ballads in one place, and all the commentary that I've done on it. And in the research of this, I've been, you know, learning a lot of things myself and trying to convey what I'm learning with you. And one of the things that I've noticed in the critics, and especially the, you know, many, many blog posts and school teachers, like the generic thing they teach about the Romantics and about Wordsworth and Coleridge, is that they were, you know, a backlash, a rebellion against reason and classicism. And I don't agree with that. I hear that all the time. And it's not fully accurate. It's too much of a broad cliche. They did have a rebellion against it, and I'm going to talk about what the rebellion was against, specific tenets and viewpoints that they should have rebelled against, that they did the right thing at that time. These things were not fully fleshed out. The ideas that were put forth in the air at this time were not 100% accurate. You know, even the idea of reason was not fully fleshed out and you know, explained properly or defended properly at this time. And often there were calls to a God and to, you know, other means and revelation and things of that nature to kind of fill in the gaps, I think. Okay, so this particular poem, I'm choosing to do these passages on this particular poem because last Sunday I did Expostulation and Reply, which is a short poem by Wordsworth, that talked about, that made an argument. It was two people, it was a school friend or the school headmaster, Matthew, who we've covered in previous podcasts. He represents basically classical education in a sense, and the education that Wordsworth gained and got and revered a lot of. Matthew is making an argument to William, who's sitting on a gray rock, just kind of looking out at nature, nothing, doing nothing. And expostulation is kind of a strong argument to do, to take some kind of action, like expostulating you to read this book, Lyrical Ballads. And in the argument, what he's saying is, you know, put away, or why are you staring dumbly at nature? Go read books. You're going to find all the information and all the knowledge of the universe in books. So go read that. And Wordsworth says, no, hold on a second. I can learn more in this, these woods. There's something special here. My senses need to be impacted by, you know, sensory experience itself, thoughtfulness, independent thinking. Those are the types of values that he is advocating for. And he is advocating against reading in that poem and in this poem. So explicitly he is saying, you know, reading books is not the answer. Now, that doesn't mean he says overall his whole picture of his philosophy of life is to not read books, but that is what's going on in these two poems. But there's something more subtle going on, because he's obviously aware of the irony that you're reading that in a book, right? And he's also aware of the value of books, that you first have to learn how to do these things, how to look at nature in books. And he wrote a lot of books, and in fact, he was a big defender of like writing books for the common masses. You know, he revolutionized certain things by making it cheaper to buy his books by using cheaper print or paper and a printing process as they came out, so that more people could have them. You know, and that was an important part, because you wanted people to buy books. And he also studied books intently, you know, and this was a big part of his life, and his whole mission in his life, for a long part of his life anyway, was to write something called The Recluse. And The Recluse, which he did write part one of, which is called The Excursion, I believe. And that, yeah, you can read that. I have not read that one yet. And he wrote The Prelude, which is considered probably the greatest of all the romantic poetic writings of this era, or of all of romantic era period. Now, So he's reading books, he's writing books, he's studying for the Recluse, for instance. The whole point of it is to kind of accumulate and put into a dramatic form all the knowledge of the universe. In the same way that, a Dante and a Milton would put forth all the, viewpoints of their era into a grand epic, right? That would go through purgatory and through, hell and through heaven, and it would get all the metaphysical and epistemological and ethical viewpoints. They explore all that in a narrative epic. And that's what he was trying to do with The Recluse. Of course, the difference is that it's much more difficult when you're talking about actual science and mathematics and, reason and logic, because you're dealing with a lot more information. But that's what he tried to do, and he did not succeed in his lifetime. But the point is that he read a lot of books to do that. Okay, so we're going to read some passages here, and I'm trying to set up the importance that these are important poems for understanding this era. Wordsworth is common for holding up and kind of expressing in a very terse, beautiful, tight way the emotional thoughts of his era, of this era. And I think this is part of it, and part of what the Romantics are rebelling against is happening in these couple poems, Expostulation and Reply, and then this one, which is the companion piece, The Tables Turned. So in Expostulation and Reply, it was Matthew, the classicist, telling Wordsworth, the romanticist, to get away from nature and read books. In The Tables Turned, it's going to be one argument, there's not going to be two characters, and it's going to be, or there's there is kind of two characters, but not two voices. So someone is speaking to somebody. And the speaker is telling somebody to put away their books and learn from nature. So it's taking the kind of opposite. And you could tell which side Wordsworth is at this point in his life. Of course, he's on the side of nature. Okay, so let's read a little bit from this preface. I want to kind of give you some ideas of what his viewpoints and what his purpose is in doing much of this. So in 1798 preface, this is the advertisement. He says, "But that while they are perusing this book, they should ask themselves if it contains a natural delineation of human passions, human characters, and human incidents. And if the answer be favorable to the author's wishes, that they should consent to be pleased in spite of that most dreadful enemy of our pleasures, our own pre-established codes of decisions." Now, this is the passage I want you to focus on. In this book, The Lyrical Ballads, while you're perusing this book, right? So remember, he's talking about a book. You're going to be reading a book, and I'm about to read a poem that is saying, put away your books, right? There's a kind of irony there, but he's being specific about this, and he's aware of this, of course. But you should ask yourselves if there is a natural delineation of human passions. So there was a view, and I'm going to get to this in Brad Thompson's book, where he talks about John Locke and Newton and their view of nature and how they revolutionized the whole, human world and the way that we experience the universe. And there's this idea that nature is reality, and that to look at nature, and I've made this argument before, is to look at reality. Now they are making a mistake, the Romantics, I think, when they don't consider things like the train and the steam engine and things like that as much nature as, wood linnets and thrush, throstles and thrushes and birds and bushes and nut trees and apple trees, streams and brooks and waterfalls. Like those are all, the Tim River and through London, like those are all nature, but the steam engine isn't quite as much nature. Now, that is a mistake they made, and I think there's a reason why they might have made that, but that's another point. The point is, though, that at a fundamental level, what they're saying is look at reality. Look at the nature of man. What is the universal nature of man? So this is a view that we no longer believe in our society. I don't think we believe anymore that mankind has a fundamental nature, that it's solid, that you can study it by observation and use reason to understand it. And that's what he's trying to do. You know, he's trying to ask you while you're perusing this book, you want to ask yourself if you think it contains, hey, you, yes, you reader, you in 2019 reader, do you think that there's a natural delineation of human passions, human characters, you know, the emotions that we experience, the types of people, you know, like I did a poem, Simon Lee, which is about an athlete, right? So that's a character, the athlete, not just an athlete, an old retired athlete who's now useless. And then the human incidents, like the idiot boy that I've read in the past, right? So do you think there's a natural, in other words, he's asking, did I hit the mark in actually assessing those subjects? Is your experience similar to mine? There's a common premise in lyrical ballads, two fundamental premises, independent thinking and thoughtfulness. So that's what he's asking you to do. He's asking you to be thoughtful. And then he says, and if the answer be favorable, so if you say yes to those, that question, that he did hit the mark in the natural delineation of human passions, etc., then that is what he has accomplished, is that he has gotten you to think for yourself, which is a difficult thing, right? Because it seems contradictory, right? To get you to think for yourself. You should do that on your own, right? But he's also trying to get you out of what he calls the enemy of our pleasures, our own pre-established codes of decision. And I think that's important and relevant to our own era and why lyrical ballads is universal for all eras and should be studied in all eras. Because we need to get out, because one of the messages is the need to get out of your pre-established code of decision, whether or not your code of decision is correct. So even if you're right in the way that you make your codes of decisions, your pre-established belief system, usually given to you by your parents, even if that's correct, you need to be capable of getting outside of that in order to really understand that it is correct. Okay, here's from the 1802 preface. It's a little bit longer, but I'm not going to take as much time to explain everything. I just want to give you a taste for what he was going after. In the 1798 preface, because they knew they were doing something radical, Coleridge and Wordsworth. So Wordsworth wrote a defense. The advertisement is a defense for what he was doing. And how he's changing the language of poetry. Everything is very different. He's taking something like what was considered low ballads. A ballad was low, it was rustic, it was for the fools, you know, it's for the birds, man. And he was trying to elevate that to something very high and mighty and, you know, and special. And I think he succeeded. But there was a backlash. He knew there was going to be, so he wrote the 1798. People really got upset about the 1798 preface, because it seemed like he was insulting their taste, which he was, but he was right in the end. They just weren't ready for it. And so he wrote the 1802 preface, which is long. And then he wrote other prefaces and other things like that. And so did Coleridge in his Biographia Literaria, where they're defending and explaining and teaching how to read their great poetry. So here's a section that's relevant to what we're talking about for this poem. The principal object, then, which I proposed to myself in these poems was to choose incidents and situations from common life and to relate or describe them throughout as far as was possible in a selection of language really used by men, and at the same time to throw over them a certain coloring of imagination, whereby ordinary things should be presented to the mind in an unusual way, and further, and above all, to make these incidents and situations interesting by tracing in them, truly though not ostentatiously, the primary laws of our nature, chiefly as far as regards the manner in which we associate ideas in a state of excitement. low and rustic life was generally chosen because in that condition, the essential passions of the heart find a better soul in which they can attain their maturity, are less under restraint, and speak a plainer and more emphatic language. Because in that condition of life, our elementary feelings coexist in a state of greater simplicity and consequently may be more accurately contemplated and more forcibly communicated. Because the manners of rural life germinate from those elementary feelings. And from the necessary character of rural occupations are more easily comprehended and are more durable. And lastly, because in that condition, the passions of men are incorporated with the beautiful and permanent forms of nature. So when we're talking about when we're talking about nature and what he's trying to do, he's doing a couple of things. He's trying to make you look at a certain character that he chose, right? In many of the poems we've done, like a mad mother, an idiot boy and his mother and their friend. And he's looking at these characters. He's investigating them. He's looking at the reality of their lives. And he's trying to apply the kind of logical reasoning that you can to the psychological character of someone like a human being, which was a Lockean idea, which is something that Locke advocated for. Apparently, I've read a little bit of Locke, but I'm learning a lot just, you know, reading America's Revolutionary Mind by Bradley Thompson, who is arguing that this is, you know, Locke was a major influence, which, you know, I think is a lot of people believe, but he's giving you a lot of evidence on like how the revolutionaries in America thought of him. But remember, he was English. This is somebody that Wordsworth studied by the time he was in college in the late 1780s. He was studying Locke intensely. So, you know, it's not a coincidence that that's happening. And he's making these arguments about looking at nature. And he phrases it like tracing the passions. And that's what he's trying to do. So he puts them, you know, they're in an incident and he's trying to show you like what kind of passions go through their mind as they experience this incident. And the event itself is not the only important thing. It's also what the event does to the character. This is a very romantic idea in literature, is the relationship between an event and the character, and that they're driving each other. And sometimes the character even drives the events rather than the events driving the character. But the idea of these event, like choosing these subjects like a mad mother or a retired old athlete as subjects worthy of study, is also because he wants to, you know, when you're asking the question, okay, so I want to prove gravity. All right. So I need to look at falling objects on Earth, but I also need to, you know, observe space because I, you know, it's not enough to prove gravity by dropping an apple. I need to prove that the same principle that applies when I drop this apple occurs in space and in the heavens. And so that the laws of the heavens apply on Earth. And that was a big revolution in terms of thinking that Newton proved. So obviously everybody knew that apples fall. And this is kind of what we say today is like, oh, you know, he proved gravity. We all know that. But what he really proved is mathematically he showed, you know, with comets and planets that he could prove where they would be and when based on his mathematical equations, thus proving that they were subject to the same laws that he could have, that you could have here on Earth. You could throw an apple off a building and predict, you know, how far it would, where it would land and how fast it would be going, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the idea of what he was doing, Newton, in physics and in nature. Now let's with physical object, inanimate objects. Now, what about animate objects? And especially what about the most complicated of all animate objects, man? And that's what Wordsworth is really contemplating and trying to figure out. He's asking, well, if I want to get to the root, the core of what man is, what should I be focused on? Should I be focused on the hoity-toity, upper class that's acting all fake and things like that? Or should I, if I really want to understand man, and the majority of men are these rural peasants, should I be looking at their lives and investigating them and their psychology? Will that get us closer to the root of human nature, just like, you know, an apple can get you to the root of all of physical reality by doing that. And that was his case. Now, whether that's true or not is something to contemplate. It's definitely not false that you can't look at those people and that they won't tell you anything about reality. But it's not necessarily true in my view that you can't, you know, also look at the noble, the rich, the hoity-toity, the kings with all their, you know, rules of behavior and things like that. Like, that's a specific, why do they do that? That's a specific question to ask about their, about human nature. But he's not wrong. Like, when you're trying to find the fundamental aspect of human nature, it's not wrong to look at these men. And that's what's in the air in 1798 and in this, you know, the Enlightenment transitioning into the Romanticist era. So let me give you a couple of just quick quotes from America's Revolutionary Mind, A Moral History of the American Revolution and the Declaration that Defined It by C. Bradley Thompson. Now, I just started reading this. I'm only in a couple chapters, like last night. So, I'm not an expert. I haven't read everything about it, of course, but it's great so far. On page 15, you know, again, this goes into what Newton and Locke and the Enlightenment thinkers brought to the world in terms of looking at nature and the laws of it in a specific way, and what I've been talking about. So he quotes, "All inanimate entities and animate beings were subject to the same mechanical laws of nature." Now, end quote for a second. That Wordsworth agrees with, I think. Like, he's saying, and in this poem I'm going to read in an Expostulation Reply and in many other poems and lyrical ballads, he's giving an idea that, okay, there are these laws, and that's what I'm trying to figure out, right? That was the quotes I was reading you earlier, where he's trying to figure out the laws that animate humans. Now, what I think he might disagree with, or at least kind of turn his nose up at a little bit, is the second part of this proposition. So let me read the whole thing now. "All inanimate entities and animate beings were subject to the same mechanical laws of nature. Laws that could be understood and expressed mathematically." Now, end quote. Now, I think he would take a little bit of gumption with the idea that everything could be understood and expressed. In other words, that mathematics controls the universe. I think he would say imagination controls the universe more, or at least has something to say in all this. And the human imagination is a miraculous thing in and of itself. And I think that's part of what he's rebelling against is, and I think that's part of the rebellion, is the second part of that proposition, that all of this, including human nature, could be expressed mathematically. And I think Wordsworth is right. I think Coleridge is correct. I don't think you can express human nature mathematically. There's not an equation for human nature. That's still how it's judged today, is either if it's not a hard science, if it's the soft sciences, even the word soft, right? That it's got this view that it doesn't, like, it's soft and that it's not accurate. It's not going to have precision in the way that you can predict the laws of gravity, for instance, and the, you know, guidance of the stars. You could predict where a star is going to end up in 100 years because of mathematics. And that's true. You can do that, but it's a fucking physical object. It's way more simple than the complexity of an entity with free will. We are the most complicated objects in the universe. And that is what he's expressing. That's what the Romantics are all about. And that's why they revere the individual. The individual is another important aspect of Romanticism, is individual thinking for yourself and the interior world of your soul, or of the individual soul, as much more grand and opulent and extreme and important than all the stars in heaven. And that is the Romantic claim, and I am the defender of that claim. I believe it is great, and we need to learn from that. Okay, let me read this last passage from page 23 that I think will hopefully solidify a lot of what I've been talking about. And this again is from America's Revolutionary Mind by Bradley Thompson. "Man's natural condition is defined by two primary qualities." And this, by the way, is from Locke. He's again going into the metaphysics and epistemology, the view of nature and reality and the view of how we know it. And then, you know, the morality of what we can do with that comes, and this is just a quick little passage about that. That's that simple subject. In the natural state, man's condition is first described as one of perfect freedom to order his actions and dispose of his possessions and persons as he thinks fit within the bounds of the law of nature, without asking leave or depending upon the will of any other man. The second fundamental quality of man's natural condition is that of equality, wherein all the power and jurisdiction is reciprocal, no one having more than any other, there being nothing more evidence than that creatures of the same species and rank promiscuously born to all the same advantages of nature and the use of the same faculties should also be equal one amongst another from subordination or subjection, unless the Lord and master of them all should be any manifest declaration of all his will set one above another. So in other words, what he's kind of arguing for here, I believe what he's saying is that in terms of the equality. So there's two. So if you're looking at human nature and at nature, at reality, you have to notice that they, in a state of nature, they're free to do what they want. They're also free to live by the consequences of what they do. Right. So if you, if you're out in nature and you try to hunt a lion and he scratches you so hard that you get gangrene and die, that's a consequence of trying to hunt a lion, right? That's possible that happens versus trying to keep away from a lion, right? And if you hunt things that are better for you or easier to catch or something by yourself. And you have the freedom to, if you hunt that lion, you kill the lion, then you have the freedom to be the king of the jungle and to eat the lion's flesh and to live longer on his, on the fat of his land, or the fat of the lion, right? And maybe you can even kill the things that the lion killed because now you are in charge of that area or something. And the point is that you look at it at state of nature, and that's how man is able to live in a state of nature, fundamental nature. And the other part is that all humans are equal. That means if you were to take all the aristocrats of the 1600s, the king, the pope, and the peasant, and you put them all in an island and you strip them naked, literally not a stitch of clothing on them, they're all the same. That's what he's saying. They're all the same. They're not going to be any different. They all have two legs and two arms and a head and eyes and other parts, and they're all the same. Now, some may be a little bit taller, some, but they're all fundamentally the same. And that's his argument in terms of equality. And the only way that you would have a difference is if God himself or the creator, assuming there is a creator, and he believed there was, I think, that if the creator came down and said, okay, yeah, this person actually is better, but he's saying that the creator has not done that, right? So it's not there. So this is this kind of state of nature that he's talking about. And Wordsworth says, okay, all right, I get it. So I'm going to look, but I'm not going to look at, I'm going to get all those people naked on an island or in the island of Britain, but I'm not going to look at the king. I'm going to look at that peasant. Let me see what that peasant's up to. And let's look at nature. And now he also is going to argue that when you're looking at nature, there's other things you can learn just by observing reality in nature. That's my argument for romanticism, is that it's teaching you, and Wordsworth particular is in this poem and other poems, is teaching you how to look at nature differently than you have, and helping you. He doesn't want to tell you to do this too much. He doesn't want to say, here's what to do. Follow X, Y, Z. If you put in this mathematical formulation, then you will come out independent thinker X, boom, blah, blah. No. He wants to show you. He's an artist. He's trying to show you, what this means and how to make this happen in terms of thinking for yourself, being thoughtful, an independent thinker. Okay, now let's go through the poem, The Tables Turned, and we will go through, so I'll read it once, like always, and then I'll go through it a little bit. Now, I think it's going to be a lot less, like I've done all the setup I think that you need and more for this particular poem. A lot of that intro is relevant to all of Lyrical Ballads, not just this poem. But this poem is The Table Turned, an evening subject on the same subject, an evening scene on the same subject by Wordsworth. And remember, the idea here is that this is a companion piece to Expostulation and Reply. And it, just to be clear again, if you haven't listened to the other poems that I've been reading on Lyrical Ballads, there is an intense value in reading all of a book of poetry, especially by a great man like Wordsworth and Coleridge, because they were, there's a reason why they included the poems they did in the order that they did. So it's, you should read it just like you read a book, and we, you know, like a novel. And yet we tend to read just a poem here, a poem there, and thus we miss some important things that they were trying to get for us. Okay, so here's The Table Turned, An Evening Scene on the Same Subject. Up, up, my friend, and clear your looks. Why all this toil and trouble? Up, up, my friend, and quit your books, or surely you'll grow double. The sun above the mountain's head, a freshening luster mellow, through all the long green fields has spread his first sweet evening yellow. Books, 'tis a dull and endless strife. Come, hear the woodland linnet, how sweet his music. On my life there's more of wisdom in it. And hark, how blithe the throstle sings. And he is no mean preacher. Come forth into the light of things. Let nature be your teacher. She has a world of ready wealth, our minds and hearts to bless. Spontaneous wisdom breathed by health, truth breathed by cheerfulness. One impulse from a vernal wood may teach you more of man, of moral evil and of good, than all the sages can. Sweet is the lore which nature brings, our meddling intellect misshapes the beauteous forms of things we murder to dissect. Enough of science and of art. Close up these barren leaves. Come forth and bring with you a heart that watches and receives. Okay, so let's see what his argument is and how he's making this argument. So this is a poetic argument. He's making an argument to put away your books, right? It starts off up, up, like get off your ass, basically. Get off your fat ass, right? Like, and Toil and Trouble is from, I think it's Macbeth from Shakespeare, you know, but the idea here is clear your looks. Like, you know, you have the look of someone engrossed in a book. You're making trouble. Right, these books are making a lot of trouble for your life. It's not helping your life. It's making you upset. It's frustrating you. And there is some truth to this. If you know, you know, the academic type book learner today that are like, well, actually, this is what they meant. Well, actually, they did that. Well, hold on a second there, good sir. You know, like the pedantic person. And it's causing trouble and strife, and you're not enjoying life. It's like, calm down, dude. All right, calm down. Chill. Chill, bro. That's, you know, so he's saying, you know, clear your looks. Why are you making trouble with everything? Come on, get up. Get off your ass, my friend. Quit your books, or surely you'll grow double. You'll be fat. That's not good. The sun above the mountain's head. So now he's starting to make the argument itself. So he's drawing a picture here. The sun above the mountain's head. I think that's a beautiful statement, right? Because you could picture that sun right above the mountain's head, a freshening luster mellow. Right? It's calming you down now. So he's making a case, not only that's going to give you wisdom, but it's going to make you healthy, right? Whereas books are going to make you unhealthy, freaked out, fat, troubled, you know, not getting laid, like all the bad things that we associate with books, some of them come here. Now, I don't agree with all of those things, of course, but I want you to try to, you know, take Wordsworth's side to understand where he's coming from here. A freshening luster mellow through all the long green fields has spread his first sweet evening yellow. So it's like, come on, man, come look at this sunset, right? Look at this beautiful sunset in nature. Walk out in nature and just look at this thing. It's amazing. Books, 'tis a dull and endless strife, right? So that you finish one book and, oh, there's 10 other books. I didn't even know this. And now I'm reading the reading recommendation list and the end of the book, which is literally what happens, you know, here. So I just read this book by Tim Blanning, The Romantic Revolution. And in the back, which is a challenging book in a certain sense. And in the back, there's like suggestions for other readings. It's like, oh man, the poems of John Keats, Memories of Beethoven, Philosophical Inquiry into the Origin of Art. It's like, whew, it's an endless strife. It's never going to end. It's more struggle trying to understand what all these, what was actually going on, and it just never ends. And Wordsworth here is saying, all right, come hear the woodland linnet, a bird. How sweet is music? On my life, there's more of wisdom in it. So, you know, well, you Kirk, you could spend all your time reading this book, or you can come listen to this woodland linnet, and there's going to be wisdom in it. Right? There's a little nice little rhyme there. Listen to the woodland linnet. There's more of wisdom in it. Kind of Dr. Seuss, it feels like. But nonetheless, that, you know, he's making the argument that you can learn something from this nature. And there is, you know, you could definitely learn from looking at nature, and it can also make you healthier in terms of calming you down, is what he's arguing. And hark, how blithe the throstle sings, another bird. And he is no mean preacher. So this is another argument, is if you have to deal with, if you've ever had to deal with academics, they tend to be mean, annoying people. No offense to academics, but they can be very mean. Like, you got to learn this. Take this quiz. Take this test. Here you go. Here's the facts. I'm going to ram down your throat. All right. Now recite it all. Recite all of, you know, Newton's, you know, Mathematica Principia or whatever. And, you know, recite it to me in the original Latin. Go. It's like, wait a second. Hold on. I just got here yesterday, bro. Calm down. I'm listening to the throstle sing. And so it's a mean preacher versus the singing bird. Singing bird is just about pleasantries and pleasure and enjoyment and experiencing the moment. And so Wordsworth is not wrong that you should be doing that, by the way. Come forth into the light of things. Let nature be your teacher. By nature, remember, he means reality. Observe using your senses, which he even talks about in the other poem, Expostulation and Reply. You don't have a choice. Your senses are what they are, and you look out in the reality of things, and it hits you, and you need a mechanism by which to structure that and to understand that. But you can do it on your own, your mind. So when you go to a book, and this is one of the classicist ideas, when you go to the books of the ancients, for instance, they had already observed reality, nature, the nature of man. They had made all the significant discoveries. All you have to do is study them and you're good. That was their basic belief. Wordsworth is saying, you know, in very Dwight terms, false. That is false. You need to think for yourself. You need to go out into nature, and that means the nature of man. Think of a state of nature for humans too, but also for woodland creatures. And for the men, but also, you know, again, the peasants, the mad mothers, the idiot boys, and his mother who's trying to make make him happy while protecting her neighbor who's sick. Or the thorn, where you have this crazy old woman who is stealing wood from this man, and she curses the owner of the land, and that he'll never be warm again because he gets her arrested, essentially. And she can't get warm herself because she can't get wood for her fire, right? So, and he's experimenting, Wordsworth, with some of these ideas of looking at nature. That's looking at nature too. Not just the throstle singing. He's not just saying just sit in nature and sit on. This is in lyrical ballads for a reason. It's the totality of lyrical ballads you have to take into consideration. And he's arguing that you need to, you know, stay in a state of nature. You need to look in a state of nature. You have to, and that means the birds, the Tim River, the Tintern Abbeys, the memories that you're going to have, your sisters and brothers, peasants, old women, crazy men, old athletes, teachers, etc. That's looking at reality. She has a world of ready wealth, nature does, our minds and hearts to bless. So remember, the wealth is our minds and hearts to bless. This is the calming yourself that's separated from reading books, which is toil and trouble and fat and double. Spontaneous wisdom breathed by health, truth breathed by cheerfulness. In 2019, we're starting to get an idea that, you know, now that it is helpful to go out into nature occasionally, and it may make you feel better. I think that's like, all right. Yeah, it's a pretty clear idea. One impulse from a vernal wood, an autumn wood, an impulse. So think about the word impulse. This is a kind of a scientific term too, like impulse, like pulsing, like your you know, veins pulse. But this one impulse from an autumn wood. So if you go into woods in the fall and you see the changing seasons, may teach you more of man. Right now, I don't think it's a coincidence that he's talking about fall and the changing of, you know, the falling leaves happening, and you looking at, you know, man, but you're looking at nature. Of moral evil and of good than all the sages can. And this is something that Locke kind of agreed with too, I think, is the idea of you have to look at reality and observe man in reality, nature, and then you can come up with morality on your own. And that's what Wordsworth is arguing here. Wordsworth is arguing that you can use your own mind and learn and go into the woods. I believe, like Wordsworth is saying, I believe in you. It may teach you, one impulse from a vernal wood may teach you, you listening right today in 2019, may teach you more of man, of moral evil, and of good than all the sages can. So all the people who thought and went into the woods themselves and then wrote it down, they wrote it down and then gave it to you. And then you can just kind of recite what they say, or you can go out and you can do it because you have what it takes. You have reason and you can do it yourself. Sweet is the lore. Lore is an important word. I mean, this is a word that means, you know, like book learning in a sense, right? We have our lore that teaches us things, that brings us stories from the past. But sweet is the lore, so nature brings its own lore. Sweet is the lore which nature brings. Our meddling intellect misshapes the beauteous forms of things we murder to dissect. Now, this is where the rebellion against the mathematical strain of the Enlightenment comes in, where everything can be dissected. Everything, you know, it's like, if you've seen, let me give you an example, it just came to my mind. You've seen superhero movies, and one of the fears, or like mutant movies, like there's a show that I couldn't really make myself watch because it didn't seem very, the acting was not that great, but it's called Raising Dion on Netflix. And there's an interesting idea that we all know about of mutants and aliens who don't want to turn themselves in because they know that humans are going to murder them to dissect them. And that's the kind of idea that I think is coming on here, is this idea that everything new has to be murdered. Has to be, you know, destroyed before we can understand it. And that's everything, rather than just looking at it in nature, right? So if we were to see a new kind of human, you know, like an evolved human all of a sudden, if someone was born who, I don't know, could read minds, we'd want to take out his brain and investigate it. And we might kill him to do it. And that's kind of what he was worried about. And, you know, I don't think it's the most false fear in the world. I think it's a little bit exaggerated, but it's a little, you know, but he's making a point here that I think is important, and he's not incorrect. Enough of science and of art. Close up these barren leaves. He's talking about his book, Lyrical Ballads. He's saying, close these barren leaves. Barren is important. Leaves are important. Leaves of a book versus leaves. I mean, this is a beautiful little metaphor here. It's very compact. Close up these barren leaves. So literally the leaves of this book, Lyrical Ballads, close them up. Put it down, go out and come forth and bring with you a heart that watches and receives. So he recognizes in it the importance of books, that you do have to get that. So he's saying, okay, you're reading this in a book. Great. Now at the end of the poem, I'm going to tell you, you've now read this. I've taught you what to do. I've shown you how to look at the head of the mountain, the sun coming up, how to listen to the throstle, how to look at, you know, the impulse of the wood and learn about moral evil and of moral evil and of good. Now it's time to close up this book, the barren leaves. So it doesn't, you know, it's not fruitful, right? Even though it kind of is, but he's kind of jabbing himself. They're not fruitful leaves. The leaves of a tree, those are fruitful. Those will give you, you know, more, teach you more of man, of moral evil and of good. Let nature be your teacher. All you have to do is watch and receive. So that is The Tables Turned. And I know I had a long introduction there, but I hope you enjoyed a little bit of that. I hope you enjoyed that and understanding what was going on in the air in the 1700s, the late 1700s. I mean, this is, you know, and why we transitioned into Romanticism, because the Romanticists didn't want to live only in a mathematical universe where even man would be murdered to be dissected. And that's all it, you know, was. Everything was just a mechanical clock. We're all robots. We don't think or have our own thoughts and ways of experiencing the world. And nothing's unique. Nothing's colored by imagination. Wordsworth comes along and says, yeah, there is a nature. Newton's right. Locke's right. But they're not fully right. There's something else. Come with me and explore the inner world and passion of man's soul. Until next time.